From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, President Trump tweeted of George Papadopoulos, the 30-year-old foreign policy aide who pled guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with Russians. Few people knew the young, low-level volunteer named George, who had already proven to be a liar. But reporters have found pictures of Papadopoulos at a high-level meeting with then-candidate Trump, and the Washington Post found audio of Trump, the candidate, praising him. The bombshell that Papadopoulos was actually arrested in July came as Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, and Manafort's deputy, Rick Gates, were put under house arrest yesterday, charged with conspiracy and money laundering. But it's the Papadopoulos charges that are considered the most significant, because we're now learning that Russians offered Papadopoulos thousands of hacked Democratic Party emails 2 months before Russian hacking of the DNC was publicly revealed last year. And that's raising a lot of questions about who knew what. Ryan Lucas covers the Justice Department for NPR. Hi, Ryan.
Hello.
First of all, a surprise, the president tweeting about Papadopoulos this morning after such serious charges.
Well, I don't know if it's a surprise. I mean, the president has made clear for the past 9 months that he's willing to tweet on just about anything, and it's kind of a way for him to vent in some instances. Whether it was wise is I think another question. Reportedly, Chief of Staff John Kelly and some of the president's lawyers, including Ty Cobb, told him to kind of be cautious on this front.
Yeah.
I mean, these are serious charges, as you note. But I think from a political and PR standpoint, this is something that the president and the White House feels that, you know, they feel that they need to respond to in some
right.
in some sense.
But it's just drawing more attention to the discrepancies. Let's listen. The White House is framing Papadopoulos as a nobody. And former campaign advisor Michael Caputo today called him a coffee boy. And in yesterday's press briefing, here's a montage of Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders repeatedly describing Papadopoulos.
It was extremely limited. It was a volunteer position. And again,
I mean, he was
a volunteer on the campaign and a volunteer. He reached out and nothing happened beyond that, which I think shows.
That's, of course, talking about how he reached out to the Russians. But he did reach out to the Trump campaign as well with what he heard from the Russians. And here's sound from then-candidate Trump's interview with The Washington Post in 2016 describing Papadopoulos, his advisor.
George Papadopoulos, he's an oil and energy consultant, excellent guy.
Okay, and then there's that picture of Papadopoulos and Trump and then Senator Jeff Sessions and others at a March 31st, 2016 planning meeting, this during the campaign. You know, all of this discrepancy, and now it's known that Papadopoulos has been talking to the FBI since his arrest in July. What are White House concerns there?
Well, I mean, Papadopoulos joined the campaign in March, and according to the court papers that were filed yesterday, he had these kind of long-running interactions with Russian or Russian proxies, proxies of the Russian government, trying to set up some sort of meeting between Trump and senior Russian officials, or between members of the Trump campaign and Russian officials, and was also told by one of his contacts that the Russians had dirt on Hillary Clinton in the form of thousands of emails. So, if Papadopoulos was communicating with senior campaign officials, as the court papers say he was, about these interactions, that means a lot of other people who were in the campaign are potentially exposed.
Well, and remember, this was in March of 2016. A couple months later, in June of 2016, we now know that Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, Donald Trump Jr. had their meeting with Russians who professed to have, you know, dirt on Hillary Clinton. Is it then assumed that FBI investigators want to know whether they knew that Papadopoulos had also made that outreach?
Well, I think that investigators want to know everything tied to that June meeting at Trump Tower that they can, because it ties into the question that is the kind of the core of the Mueller probe, which is possible ties between Russians and the Trump campaign, and was there any coordination? You know, that's something that, irregardless of what Papadopoulos did, I think that Trump Tower meeting is of interest to investigators anyways. And I think it would be safe to assume that.
Yeah. There's fallout elsewhere. Powerful Democratic Party lobbyist Tony Podesta, the brother of Hillary Clinton's campaign chair, John Podesta, whose emails were hacked, stepped down from his lobbying firm yesterday because of his connections to Paul Manafort's lobbying work for Ukraine. Manafort had asked Podesta to do some of that lobbying work for the Russian-backed president of Ukraine. Gets pretty complicated here because, you know, is the suspicion that Tony Podesta might also have been working for the Russians against his brother's Democratic campaign? I mean, what could be the questions there?
I think that this ties more into the issue of not declaring oneself as an agent of a foreign government, which is mm-hmm. what lobbyists are supposed to do. This is what got Manafort and his associate Rick Gates into trouble yesterday with their indictment. One of the charges stems from not registering as a foreign agent for a foreign government.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really what that ties back into, not so much the Russia collusion question.
Is Washington waiting for shoes to fall?
Well, everyone is kind of on edge here. And the fallout from yesterday's charges continue to have these ripple effects, Podesta being one of them. But, you know, people want to know where this is going to go from here. And mm-hmm. there are a lot of potential avenues for the Mueller investigation to go.
Ryan Lucas covers the Justice Department for NPR. Ryan, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, President Trump's transgender military ban is on hold. Yesterday, a federal judge granted a preliminary injunction that halts a major part of Trump's directive on transgender military service until litigation is complete. That means that for now, transgender recruits can continue to enlist and serve openly in the military. Sarah Harris of North Country Public Radio reports.
For most of his life, this service member lived as a woman, but he struggled with his gender identity. And a couple years ago, his wife suggested he start trying out what it might feel like to be a man.
We started really small, like just using pronouns in the house, and she would say husband, and felt like this huge weight was just lifted from my shoulders, and everything in my life just kind of started making sense.
This service member spoke to us on condition of anonymity because he didn't get permission from his higher-ups to do this interview. He wanted to transition, but he had to figure out how to navigate his identity at work.
Once we kind of decided that this is what I wanted to do, I notified our department head of the branch that I'm in, and he basically told me it could be a career ender or we could make it work.
This service member loves his job. It's rigorous and allows him to travel all over the world. So he got an official diagnosis, started taking testosterone. His body changed. Because his job has strict health requirements, he had to tell his peers before he was ready.
I felt like all of a sudden there was a spotlight on me everywhere I went. And when I came out as transgender, it was like everyone was just waiting for me to mess up and give them a reason that I shouldn't be serving.
His solution? Double down and work harder. He finished that training, moved to a new duty station. It took his new leaders a while, but now they get his pronouns right and see him as a full member of their team.
I didn't demand anything from my unit. I didn't demand acceptance. I didn't demand medical care or anything. I just showed up and did my job, and I think they really respected that I put the mission first before myself.
His branch officially recognized his preferred gender this spring. This summer, President Trump tweeted that transgender individuals will no longer be allowed to serve in the military. White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders said the president believes that allowing transgender people to serve is costly and disruptive.
And based on consultation that he's had with his national security team, came to the conclusion that it erodes military readiness and unit cohesion.
But despite President Trump's position, the service member's gotten a big outpouring of support.
I have a lot of people that have already walked up to me and said, you know, I would go to battle with you and that, you know, they would fight it till the end for me.
Advocates like Sasha Bookert say they've heard that from a lot of trans service members. Bookert is a lawyer for Lambda Legal, an LGBTQ advocacy group that's suing the government over the transgender ban. It's one of four lawsuits challenging the policy. Bookert is a trans woman and a Marine veteran, so this suit is personal for her.
You know, there were a lot of moments where, you know, I was very worried that I would be discovered and purged and drummed out of the military. And unfortunately, the president wants to return us to, you know, that era where people had to hide who they are and live in fear. But we're not going to let them do it.
Yesterday, a federal judge granted a preliminary injunction that halts implementation of President Trump's directive on transgender troops until litigation is complete. The judge ruled that military policy should revert to the status quo and allow transgender troops to enlist and serve openly. The judge wrote in her memorandum that she doesn't have jurisdiction over the part of President Trump's directive that prohibits military funds from being used for gender reassignment surgery. The service member we spoke to wants to have a long military career, one where he hopes transgender troops are welcome.
Having these kind of individuals in the unit should just be open-minded and let them, you know, establish themselves and become who they're going to be and judge them off of that, not the label of being transgender.
Unless the White House policy moves forward, he plans to keep doing his job. For Here and Now, I'm Sarah Harris.
A U.S. district judge has ordered Flint, Michigan to come up with a long-term water source, but the city still hasn't made a decision about where it will get its water in the future. It's been 3 years since the water crisis began in Flint. In a moment, we're going to hear about the health problems some residents are experiencing because of it. But first, we're joined by Steve Carmody, who's a reporter with Michigan Radio. Steve, welcome.
Thank you.
And first, just give us a reminder briefly of what happened in Flint. How did we get to this point?
Well, in order to save money with the city, the state tried to change the city's water source to a cheaper source. But in the interim, they had to move to the Flint River as a backup. But the water wasn't properly treated, and that caused all kinds of different problems. It increased lead in the water. It may have increased bacteria and possibly causing health problems for people in the city.
And 15 former and current state officials are now facing criminal charges in connection with the water crisis. What's the status of those cases?
Well, of the 15, two have already reached plea agreements with prosecutors, and they're cooperating with the investigation. At this point, the others are going through the preliminary exam phase, where a judge is determining whether the evidence against them is significant enough to warrant going to trial. Now, tomorrow, the highest profile official who's been charged, the director of the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, Nick Lyon, his preliminary exam continues, and he's facing a charge of involuntary manslaughter in connection with a deadly outbreak of Legionnaire's disease that took place during the switch to the Flint River.
And of all the people charged, Lyons is the person who is seen as closest to the governor of Michigan, who many people who've been following this say is also responsible, although he hasn't been charged.
No, at this point, the governor is not facing any criminal charges, although the prosecutor's office say that their investigation continues. And as a matter of fact, during a previous hearing, an aide to the governor in his testimony, raised some questions about whether the governor's testimony before Congress was accurate about when he learned about the Legionnaire's disease outbreak. And so that's raising some other questions about what potential charges he could be facing, not just at the state level, but possibly running into problems with Congress.
You spoke with the mayor, Karen Weaver, yesterday. What did she tell you?
Well, we talked about a number of different things, but she's very frustrated. She's been mayor for 2 years now. And she still is the mayor of a city that is not completely in charge of its own fate.
It's really sad when we have to have someone like the state still making decisions for us. I mean, we fought so hard to get home rule, and we almost have it. And for us to have the state, a federal judge, making decisions for us and about us, it's really a shame.
So still some anger there. What about trust in Flint? Do people at this point trust officials and trust that the water is safe?
Well, the basic answer to that question is no. Residents in Flint do not trust anything they hear from the folks at the state level or even the federal level. Mayor Weaver is facing a recall election next week because of people's questions about the way she's been running the city. So the trust level is just zero among people who live in Flint. And of course, you know, people are still stopping at distribution centers, picking up bottles of water, filters for their taps, even though state officials have been saying for most of this year that the water is safe to drink, although they still suggest that people use a filter.
Earlier this year, a $97 million settlement with the state was approved, and that money is supposed to go to inspect and replace water lines in Flint. How much progress has been made in tearing out old lines and replacing them?
It's a long process. At this point, about 6,000 service lines have been replaced. Now, service lines are the pipes that connect people's homes and businesses to city water mains. And that was the main source of the lead that was leaching into water. Now, they've replaced 6,000. There's another 14 to 15,000 service lines that need to be replaced, and that's going to take at least a couple more years to do. But that doesn't account for pipes and fixtures in people's homes that were damaged by the water, and just, you know, other problems with the city's water system that will cost tens of millions of dollars to fix. It's a long-term problem that the city is going to be spending many, many years fixing.
That's Steve Carmody, who is a reporter with Michigan Radio, updating us on the situation in Flint. Steve, thank you.
You're welcome.
And joining us now is Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, who is a pediatrician in Flint, who was an important voice in exposing the health crisis happening there. Doctor, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And what are things like now? I know that you treat children every day there. Are you still seeing health problems from the water crisis?
Health problems are not immediately seen from lead exposure. It's known as a silent pediatric epidemic. It's something that we see years, if not decades, after exposure to lead. But what we see in Flint today is an ongoing crisis. The people of Flint, the kids I take care of every day, are still on filtered water, still on bottled water. So that has not changed. The water quality is improving, but we do not yet have an all clear.
Have you seen any of the consequences yet up until this point?
Well, the science of lead exposure is based on the field of epidemiology, which is all about populations. Nothing can be really attributed to individual patients. Right now, everybody in Flint is blaming everything on the water crisis. A child's learning problems, grandma's early dementia, new onset malignancy. It's very difficult to prove causation because a lot of these things that happen because of lead exposure can be caused by many different things.
What kind of things are you looking for as a doctor? What do you think could be caused by the lead exposure?
Sure. So the science of lead exposure is clear. We know what it does. It drops IQ levels, so it leads to problems with cognition, school problems, and it causes behavioral problems. We are leaning on that field of epidemiology to see how children are doing. We were just funded to build a registry for Flint. A registry is this large-scale database to see how the people of Flint are doing very objectively. But the goal of this registry is not to just study the people. The goal of this registry is to see how they're doing, get them connected to the resources that we know will help them, and then to follow up with them later.
And are the effects of lead exposure reversible at all? Are there things you can do if it's clear that somebody was exposed and is having health problems as a result?
That's a great question, and that's why this story is so tragic. Lead is a potent, irreversible neurotoxin. There is no cure. There is no antidote. However, there is so much that we can do and that we are doing to minimize, to mitigate, to buffer the impact of this exposure. We are wrapping our children with science-based interventions that we know will promote their brain development. For example, in Flint, we have universal preschool. It's the only city in Michigan to have that. We have two brand new child care centers. We have a robust investment in early education. We have Medicaid expansion. We have mobile grocery stores, breastfeeding services, 24-hour mental health care. These are things that we know will minimize the impact of this exposure.
Now, as we mentioned, you helped uncover this Flint water crisis. What do you think now when you look back today and now that you're having to monitor so many of the residents of Flint and watch for these health problems? What do you think about what happened there?
I wish I could press rewind because it was all entirely preventable. We didn't have to be in the spot. It was a cost-cutting measure that made us change our water source, and that water source wasn't treated properly. However, we are here today, and it's my job as a pediatrician to make sure our children are healthy today. But more importantly, it's my job to make sure that they have the brightest future possible.
Do you believe that what happened was criminal?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why you see so many criminal charges. So there was a water that was supposed to be treated properly. It was needed this ingredient called corrosion control. It's a necessary ingredient to water treatment. It was not added. It was not added even when the water treatment folks were told that it was supposed to be added. And then there was a series of cover-ups. This was criminal.
Do you think that this could happen in another city now that we know the effects in Flint?
Absolutely. And we hear almost every week about another city or another school district that is testing and finding lead in our water, because we do have lead in our water. We were stubbornly slow as a nation to restrict lead from our plumbing, even though we've known about the evil of lead for really centuries. We didn't restrict it from our service lines, which are our pipes that go from the water main to someone's house, until 1986. But what's most frightening is we didn't restrict it from our brass fixtures until 2014. So there is lead in all of our plumbing, especially in the Northeast and the Midwest. And the laws that regulate lead in water, specifically the lead and copper rule that's part of the Safe Drinking Water Act, is weak, and it allows gaming of the sampling and the monitoring and the fixing of lead in water. Right now, the EPA had an opportunity to strengthen that rule, and they said, hey, we're going to pass on this. We're not going to strengthen this. We're not going to learn from Flint, and we're going to let countless other children be exposed to a neurotoxin.
Do you feel like this story about Flint's water crisis has faded from the headlines, that a lot of people around the country probably think it's over, it's dealt with?
Yeah, absolutely, because we're flooded with different crazy stories every day in this nation. We largely feel that the national media has left us. And when I go around and I talk, and I remind people, we're still on filtered water, we're still on bottled water, we're doing great things, but we yet to have kind of a plan for our long-term recovery. Do not forget Flint. Flint is not done.
That's Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, who's a pediatrician who helped uncover the Flint water crisis and still works in the city today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
There's a current debate over the national anthem and the NFL, but there was another time when the Star-Spangled Banner collided with politics, race, and a major sporting event. Baseball this time, and not an athlete, a singer. 49 years ago this fall, it was Jose Feliciano at the World Series. Karen Grigsby Bates from NPR's Code Switch team reports.
It was 1968, Game 5 of the World Series. Detroit versus St. Louis at Tiger Stadium. And a young guy with long hair and sunglasses strummed his acoustic guitar and sang.
Oh, can you see?
Jose Feliciano has been blind from birth. The sunglasses weren't a hip affectation, so he couldn't see the audience's reaction, which was varied.
After I sang it, it was really strange for me to hear me being booed as well as yays. And I didn't know what happened.
If he didn't immediately, he soon did. There was a national outcry about the singer's stylized version. Some people hated the changed melody. Thousands of veterans felt this anthem was an insult to their service. Feliciano said he didn't intend for his Latin jazz version of the anthem to be disrespectful or an anti-war sentiment.
For me, it wasn't a protest thing. I did it to show my appreciation to America for what they had done for me.
Born in Puerto Rico, Feliciano moved to New York with his parents when he was 5. He loved life in his new home.
It's like when I came from Puerto Rico, I went to a baseball game, and I thought they were singing to me because they were singing, "Oh, Jose, can you see?"
He's joking, kind of. But eventually, the blind kid from Puerto Rico was singing to America. His twist on The Doors' Light My Fire burned up the charts and led to an invitation to sing at the World Series. He was 23. The controversy, though, almost snuffed out a promising career.
I was a little depressed, to tell you the truth, because I had things happening for me. I had 2 songs on the charts. I had Light My Fire and High Heeled Sneakers. And then they stopped playing me, like I felt like I was the plague or something.
Even though top 40 stations blackballed him, Feliciano remained tremendously popular on college campuses. He continued to tour and cut records. And something else happened. His improvisation on the anthem opened the door to a bunch of other people with their own versions. Jimi Hendrix, Marvin Gaye, Garth Brooks, Billy Joel, Beyoncé, Lady Gaga, and Whitney Houston's now iconic performance in 1991 at the height of the Gulf War.
Oh, You know, the only thing I can say about all these versions, they wouldn't have done it if I hadn't have done it. And I'm glad that I did.
Which is not to say issues around the anthem haven't been controversial. Feliciano thinks that's ironic.
It's just strange to me how all of a sudden the anthem has become something to talk about.
Again. As for the NFL players taking a knee during the anthem?
I don't think kneeling for the anthem is such a bad thing. In a sense, they're doing what they feel.
And so is he. He's been invited to sing the anthem several times since his initial performance in 68. And he still sings it his way. Karen Grigsby-Bates, NPR News.
This week, Facebook, Google, and Twitter are appearing before the House and Senate Intelligence Committees to testify about Russian influence in the 2016 presidential election and take questions about how Russian-backed trolls use the social media platforms to spread disinformation. They're also likely to take questions about why it took the company so long to notice it. Here to explain our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ed Lee is managing editor of Recode. Hi, Ed.
Hey.
And start with Facebook. It was leaked yesterday that Facebook now says more users have been affected than previously thought. What exactly did the company say?
So Facebook revealed that about 126 million Facebook users in the U.S. were exposed in some form or another to, you know, this Russian troll operation of trying to influence U.S. election. Basically, one in two Facebook users in the United States likely saw some of this content. So between you and me, at least one of us did.
Well, and as others have pointed out, that's about as many as voted. So
right,
potentially
exactly.
All the voters. But unlike Facebook, Google has not commented on Russian use of its platform. What are we likely to hear today from them?
So they also found Russian meddling, but the numbers are modest, about $4,700 in ad spend related to sort of Kremlin-backed activities and about 18 YouTube channels. So, but to put that into context, you know, when Facebook first told us, they said, oh, 10 million people were affected by this, and now they're saying 126 million. So chances are, if and when Google goes deeper, they will find more.
Well, Twitter originally said 200 accounts were used by the Russian-linked organization Internet Research Agency. Now they're saying 2,700 accounts, a lot more. What is the deal here? I mean, is this a cultural thing? Because some are saying that at Facebook, for instance, there was a kind of an attitude of let's only talk about the good things that Facebook can do and let's not explore the negative. And so even if somebody wanted to propose, well, what should we do if this happens, maybe that voice would be stymied. Is it a cultural thing?
It is definitely a cultural thing. There is this pervasive feeling in Silicon Valley that we're changing the world. And frankly, they are. But at the same time, they're not taking a closer look at themselves in terms of things that they may be, you know, doing that aren't great. And I think this is a clear example of that. I mean, deeper context, though, is that a lot of these things that Russians are doing, for example, are hard to track. They're not always easy to see right away. They're not paying money for a lot of these so-called organic posts. They're just fake sort of accounts posting opinion, you know, rightly or wrongly. But the point is they're not necessarily paying for it. So, again, it's harder to see off the bat.
Well, you know, we did a story recently with a company that consults with other companies to teach them how to prepare for what could go wrong. You know, just come try to think up what could go wrong. But what could come from these testimonies? Legal punishment? What, oversight?
Well, I think the deeper fear from Facebook and Google and Twitter is that U.S. government will basically regulate their companies. I don't think that Congress wants to do that either. I think if anything, the tech companies are open to some light regulation as it relates to political advertising. But here's what we've discovered from yesterday's announcement is basically that, you know what, a lot of it wasn't the advertising component that was the cause. It was just these organic posts. At one point is, you know, this First Amendment issue, or at what point is this sort of like an espionage and state issue?
Right.
And that's the big question
here. Right. And just very briefly, we hear about Facebook bringing on tons of employees to look for this stuff. Can you stop it?
There's so much content being posted every day. I don't think so. I think you have to hire so many more people, on top of which you would have to employ some kind of algorithm to sort of aid you. So I think they can get close, but it's never going to be 100%. I think the answer is going to be how quickly can they sort of deal with it as it's being discovered, more so than sort of figuring it out beforehand or as it's happening.
Yeah. Ed Lee, managing editor of Recode, as Twitter, Facebook, Google testified today before House and Senate committees. Ed, thank you.
Anytime.
Well, it's Halloween, which means I still have some candy to buy to give out. But also, we've been hearing a lot of scary music. maybe a lone piano playing dissonant notes in the distance, or an off-kilter lullaby playing on a music box. Those are sound cues that let you know something terrible is about to happen. But why do they scare us so much? Here's Max Green of WBEZ in Chicago.
It's a dark and stormy night. You're home alone, ready to watch a scary movie, so you turn off the lights and settle in with a bowl of popcorn. The opening credits flash on the screen. After a few minutes, you're engrossed, but suddenly thinking, maybe this wasn't such a good idea. You're looking over your shoulder every few moments, and you're hyper-aware of the sounds around you. A tree branch tapping softly at the window, a creaking floorboard, a metal gate swinging back and forth outside. You're on edge, but nothing scary has actually happened yet on screen, so why is the hair on your neck standing up? It may be all the cues your ears are picking up on that your eyes haven't, sound cues that tell you tension is rising and something is probably going to happen soon.
The ear in general has a far more direct line to your emotional response.
That's Kubilai Uner. He teaches music composition for the screen at Columbia College Chicago. He says in scary movies, the ear plays a big role in creating fear.
I think it has to do with the fact that it's always on. You can't close your ears. And it's the only thing that can look behind you.
Uner says composers can use sound design and music to make the viewer feel unsettled.
Basically, what you're trying to do is somehow take away the sense of safety and control from the audience.
But when it comes to music, context is key. Notes and combinations of notes aren't objectively creepy sounding. Rather, horror movies have given us a kind of language that's taught us to fear certain tones. Uner uses a piano in his classroom to explain.
Complicated intervals can sound what we commonly call dissonant, and they can be employed to be scary. So you have something like this. And out of context, that sounds a little scarier than...
But take that same dissonant chord and add a few notes in the middle.
I can make it kind of pretty and more like a question mark.
Music composers have lots of strategies at their disposal to facilitate different kinds of scares. Take Alfred Hitchcock's classic Psycho, for example.
Where it's just horrific, employing almost a physical gesture, those screechy violins that keep coming, weep, 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 weep. It's really just painting the movement of somebody with a knife stabbing, and you have that high sound which suggests metal.
And then there are brooding low tones, what you might expect to hear looking down a dark hallway or across open water, like the incessant rumble in Jaws.
You have these many primal ways of scaring people acoustically, and I think it has to do with the function that we're used to using our ears as alarm mechanisms.
Science tells us Uner's theory isn't that far off from the truth. All of those elements he mentioned scare us for a reason. It's why we use words like primal or visceral to describe fear. Scary sounds act as a stimulus and evoke a biological response from our bodies. Daniel Blumstein studies evolution and biology at the University of California in Los Angeles, and he's curious about why certain sounds evoke this fear response in people. But he's not a fan of horror movies. What got him thinking about this was actually much... cuter.
Marmots.
Marmots are kind of like big squirrels.
And through a serendipitous experience I had, I was holding a baby marmot and suddenly it screamed and I had this emotional response. And I wondered why I'm having an emotional response to a rodent, you know, screaming.
And just for reference, this is what a screaming baby marmot sounds like. Blumstein says when he heard that, his body reacted, his heart skipped a beat, and he started thinking,
maybe there's a general principle at play that can help us understand why we respond certain ways to certain types of music and certain types of soundtracks.
And when Blumstein examined those screams, he found sonic elements in them that actually correspond with some of the same sound ingredients that make up jarring, noisy tones or dissonant music.
Raspy, staticky. Some of these may be rapid frequency upshifts and rapid frequency downshifts, which might come across as warbles.
He found that noisy sorts of sounds naturally produced by vocal cords in alarming circumstances make us feel afraid.
I think the people that have been making films and music have implicitly known this, but what our work has shown is sort of the reason why. And this hypothesis links us to our ancestors, not just our human ancestors, but our non-human ancestors.
So rest assured, film composers and scorers are well aware of the timeless tools they have at their disposal to keep you on the edge of your seat. For Here and Now, I'm Max Green in Chicago.
Scared yet? That story comes to us from WHYY's The Pulse. You're listening to Here and Now.
Brock Long, the head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, said today that FEMA is spending more than $200 million each day in its response to the three major hurricanes and huge wildfires that hit in the last 2 months. In Puerto Rico, there are big questions about one $300 million contract. Several news outlets are reporting that the FBI has opened an investigation into the contract awarded to a tiny Montana company to rebuild the island's electrical power grid. Whitefish Energy got the contract. It had only two employees at the time, and it didn't go through a competitive bidding process. It's also based in the hometown of Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, who says he had nothing to do with it. On Sunday, the governor of Puerto Rico canceled the contract, and joining us for the latest from Miami via Skype is Alan Gomez of USA Today. Hi, Alan.
How you doing?
Doing well. And what more do we know at this point about how Whitefish got this contract?
I think we're not going to figure out the full details of this for some time, because at this point, we now have the FBI is basically just the latest to jump into this. Prior to this, the governor of Puerto Rico had requested that the Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General inspect this process. Democrats in Congress have called on the GAO to investigate this. There's Republicans and Democrats in Congress calling for hearings to investigate what happened. And I think when you put all that together, it kind of shows just how this has become a pretty broad across the board call to investigate what happened, because there's a standardized process that's traditionally used in the United States to respond to these disasters and to coordinate electrical recoveries. And this just went so far away from it that, yeah, there's just all these questions. And that's what hopefully some of these investigations will get to.
Well, and it's not just that the company had two full-time employees, as we said, but also some of the aspects of the contract are raising eyebrows. The rates they're paying, $319 per hour for a subcontracted lineman, $332 a day for lodging.
Yeah, and I can tell you that responses to other hurricanes are less than that. So if you're a power company coming from, let's say, Georgia, going down to Florida, yeah, you do get more, you know, more money than you do on a regular shift. When you're responding to a hurricane, it's very hard work. You usually work 16-hour days, 7 days a week when you're on these shifts. But I've spoken to a couple of these local utilities, one of the very few who've actually made it down to Puerto Rico since news of this Whitefish cancellation came out. And even they were telling me, yeah, we thought the rates were a little high. I mean, we weren't going to complain, but we thought they were a little high what they were charging or what we were going to be getting. And so, yeah, everyone's got a lot of questions about how this came to be.
Well, there's also been some question about FEMA's involvement. The contract says FEMA has reviewed and approved the deal, but FEMA says it never saw it. Can you shed any light on that?
Yeah, I mean, FEMA is very clearly trying to get as far away from this as possible. Yeah, there were questions before with FEMA's response to Puerto Rico, and that fits into the broader idea of, you know, why it's taken so long and why the feds haven't stepped up as much as they could. There was an expectation at some point that FEMA would have a more active role in directing the electrical response. But then, you know, we all got blindsided by the Whitefish deal. FEMA says they had nothing to do with it, that they didn't even look at the contract until after it was signed. But there are questions about that as well, because it's really hard to believe that the Puerto Rican Power Authority could go through this process that they said that they did. And they said that they put out a call for bids and that Whitefish just happened to be one of two companies that responded that could even do the work. And yeah, it's just this entire process from start to finish has just gotten so convoluted that, yeah, it might take something like the FBI to really resolve it.
And the $300 million, by the way, that would have come from the bankrupt Puerto Rican Power Authority or from the federal government, or do we know?
Some combination thereof. When this usually happens, it's the local power authority that's responsible for doing the upfront payments. But then they eventually get reimbursed, not fully, but to a very large degree from the federal government. In this case, the worry was that the Puerto Rican Power Authority, already having filed for bankruptcy and already $9 billion in debt, did not have that upfront money to pay these local crews that would be coming from other states. But yeah, eventually they would have been repaid by the federal government, or at least that's the expectation.
So who's going to take over the work now of fixing Puerto Rico's electric grid?
That's a great question. I think the most frustrating thing for folks in Puerto Rico throughout this process is that there already is a process for this. And we've seen it from California to Texas to Florida to New York after Sandy. There is a standardized process where there's two organizing councils in the U.S., trade groups that coordinate power companies to go down and respond. And it works very well, as we saw in Harvey in Texas and Irma in Florida. But Puerto Rico did not activate that. They did not request that after this hurricane. They instead went with Whitefish. And now we thought, okay, they're canceling Whitefish, the Whitefish contract. They're going to activate that process. But instead, what they're going to do is they've requested that specifically the states of Florida and New York come down and organize that and help them out. Hmm. Those two states weren't picked at random. That's where about 40% of people of Puerto Rican descent live on the U.S. mainland. So it makes sense that they would be involved, but I don't think we've ever seen a process like this where two state governments are asked to take over the electric restoration system. So again, it makes some sense, but it's deviating from the standard process, which is probably going to lead to a couple of questions down the road as well.
That's Alan Gomez with USA Today. Alan, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.